hope.
Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone, from rainy New York City. We are having showers, but it's going to get very sunny, and this book that I'm going to talk about is phenomenal. But first, I would like to welcome you to MJ Network. MJ stands for my sister, Marcia Joyce, whose memory I remember every day and keep her alive through my radio station and other means. But first, before I start, and welcome Lee Matthew Goldberg, whose book is The Desire Card, and give you the promo from my book review that's going to set everybody wanting to read it, I have to do this. Happy birthday, Aiden. I promised you, and because your aunt has this habit of making sure everybody really knows it's your birthday, it wouldn't be me if I didn't write a poem, a short one. Aiden, you are my special nephew. Now you are officially a teenager, so true. 13 years old and bright and smart and athlete and more. Your teenage years are exciting. There is so much more in store. Middle school is the start, and good grades I know you get. Your energy and will to learn is fantastic, so never forget. You can do anything you want, and you grow up to do great things, so true. You are my nephew, and I'm so proud of you that you are part of my life, you know. So happy birthday, Aiden. I promised you I was going to announce it on my radio show. Anne Franny, love you so much. And now, this is about, book is about control, forgiveness, power, fate, uncertainty. And one man named Harrison only wanted to be free. I needed someone in his life, but when you desire something so badly and sell yourself to the notion that one phone call can get you anything you want, think twice before you pick up the phone and press send. Some faiths and some desires may cost you a heavy price. Will Harrison ever be free? And after you listen to this, would you want your own desire card? Welcome, Lee Matthew Goldberg, the author. Hi. This is exciting.
Hi, friend. Yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited for the interview.
Well, tell us about Harrison and his job at Sanford & Company, and what happens after you've been with a company for so long that he's fired. And I know that this can happen. People can be fired because of an illness, and from what I gather, they can't do that. But how come they fired him, and how did he feel about it?
Yeah, so Harrison works at Sanford & Company. It's a mergers and acquisitions company down on Wall Street. And a lot of it is sort of meeting clients face-to-face. So as Harrison's illness sort of progresses, he has liver cirrhosis, and he's not looking very well, they use that as sort of a means to fire him. So it's not technically firing him for his illness. It's almost firing him because he's not appealing to the clients anymore. If maybe he wanted to take them to court, then he could sue them. But I think he's just so kind of shocked by the firing. He's been with the company for about 20 years. He's really given them everything. I mean, he's almost lost his family for them. And that dealt with the blow from learning about his liver cirrhosis. I think it's almost just too much for him to process, where he really doesn't have the fight in them to fight them anymore.
That is so sad. And people, those of you that drink, I think twice about that after you read this book, let me tell you.
Yes. Harrison definitely has enjoyed drinks, alcohol, pills as well, sort of anything really to keep him up, because his job was so demanding that he needed something to avoid sleeping, basically. And then it winds up taking a toll on his liver by the time he's around 45.
I don't think people realize that. They just sort of like go on a binge when they get upset.
It becomes a habit and you get used to it. And some people's bodies are able to handle things that others aren't. And he obviously wasn't really built to treat his body in that way. And it sort of bites him, down the road.
No, the only thing I drink is lots of caffeine. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's, you know, everybody needs advice in some way, but it's all moderation and balance, and, you know, balancing that with a healthy diet as well. If you want to have a drink, but, you know, also have a kombucha or something else to balance it.
So tell us about this severance package and what would alter his life, and why did he think this was so great?
So the severance package was basically 6 months pay plus health benefits for all of his family. So it would give him a chance to really look for another job without too much pressure. But for him, it's sort of not enough. And he fears just sort of where his age is at. All these new people would be after jobs that he would be looking for, and he would have a really hard time kind of finding it. And then the other bonus that comes along with the severance package is they give him what's called a desire card, which is given to sort of elite people in the company. And it's a card that promises any wish fulfilled for the right price. And it's really a way of just kind of, you know, pushing him aside. So for them, I think because they fire him, as we talked about, in a very unfair way, giving him this little bonus, maybe we'll make the severance package and the firing a lot easier for him. But then as readers know who read the book, it never turns out easy for Harrison, unfortunately.
I don't think this would turn out easy for anyone. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of...
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. It's fine. I don't think it would be easy for anybody, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you dangle something that sounds so great on paper, there's always a consequence.
Yeah.
So nothing ever comes that easily, almost. And it never comes easy for Harrison.
Well, I don't think Harrison was thinking about the consequences. He was thinking about the positives. Yeah, a lot of people do. So
tell us
about his relationship with Helene and his children, because that was kind of tenuous, too.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, their relationship isn't great. Like I said before, he really put everything into his career. So he's working sometimes 16-hour days, and then he gets home and sleeps a little bit. So they almost are living separate lives. It's when he's at home, he's sleeping, and they're already, you know, he's already gone in the morning before they go to school. So he really doesn't have a relationship with his kids. And his kids are 14 and 8 years old. And he's missed their really entire childhood. And that's also put a pressure on he and his relationship with his wife, Helene, where it's almost like they're passing strangers in the night, basically.
There's a lot of people like that. It's really sad. But her father hates him, doesn't he? He doesn't like him at all.
Yes. I mean,
doesn't he like him? I don't like him either.
Yeah, I mean,
the father.
Right. He's a hard person. Oh, the father. Yeah, the father's not the nicest person either. I think that Helene comes from a lot of money, and the father is a very, very wealthy CEO of a corporation. Mm-hmm. The corporation's never quite named in the book. And I think he expected great things for his daughter, and Harrison never sort of fit up with that that ideal. They met in college, and when they met, Harrison came from a very sort of poor, abusive family, which somewhat explains sort of the person that he became, that he always has been sort of wrestling with these demons inside of him. But for a character like Helene's father, I think he pictured the ideal boyfriend, husband, and Harrison just never lived up to that. And then he sort of sees the way that Helene is treated, that, you know, she has a husband that's really never around. So I think any father wouldn't be a fan of his, but Helene's father definitely takes it to a higher level.
He certainly does. So she works for a nonprofit organization, and you meet her children, and they're spoiled.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously,
yeah.
The daughter about getting the lead in ballet, and it's almost like the grandfather. She has to be the best one on top.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is very relevant. Why is this such a relevant issue? There are a lot of kids like that. that feel that, you know, I have to be the best and whatever. And if they're not, they get depressed. And she's like, the mother, like, lays into her. Doesn't matter. She just gives into her. Why is that? That's horrible. My mother would never do that.
Yeah, mine wouldn't either. I was not raised like that. You know, I think, you know, we talked about some of the blame that, that Harrison has, but I think, you know, Helene also has a little bit of blame too in terms of the way that the kids have been raised. It's in her defense, it's sort of all on her. So she's had to handle everything. She works for a nonprofit, but she really volunteers. So it's not a full-time position. So while it's stressful, you know, there are people with a lot more stressful jobs that wouldn't use that as an excuse. So you can't really let her off the hook, you know, in terms of that. And I think it's sort of a New York mentality. You know, they live on Central Park, on Central Park in a very expensive building. You know, the maintenance is crazy. It's a little bit that keeping up with the Joneses mentality. And then the kids, the kids are influenced by that as well. So it becomes always the pursuit of goals and, you know, what you can get rather than just living life. I mean, when I was a kid and I was eight, I didn't really have that many stresses. You know, I played with my friends. I went to school. I hung out. I did my homework. I played basketball. But for Helene's daughter, you know, ballet becomes her ultimate. And for the son, soccer becomes his ultimate. So each person in the family sort of has a pursuit that is taking them outside of the family and is becoming more important and actually just spending time together and being a family. And it's sort of a representation throughout the book that, that people don't really have their eye on what's important and they're looking more for monetary gain or you know, personal gain. Or like I said before, sort of a keeping up with the Joneses mentality.
It's so true today because I hear kids talk on the street. I hear people in all neighborhoods, and I want to be like that. I want those shoes. I want that. I have to have that.
I grew up in New York, and it was a very different New York when I grew up. And the amount of wealth that exists here now is very kind of difficult to see sometimes because there's people with sort of so much, and then you also have, you know, people with very little as well.
I grew up on the South Bronx, and we were not rich at all. And it didn't even bother me.
Right,
it never bothered me that I didn't have designer shoes or whatever. And my mom bought me the same dress in $17 for, you know, whatever it was. And I don't remember ever asking for anything because I didn't care.
Yeah.
The only thing I ever asked for were books. That's it. I said to her, give me my library card or just let me go out and buy 100 million books to read. And I was a happy girl.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you were a good kid. I think a lot of parents would be
so
happy
perfect
to have a kid like that. Just all they wanted is to read.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's not about, designer things and, you know, like Helene's kids.
It wasn't. As a matter of fact, I mean, forget it. I mean, as a matter of fact, if I wasn't for straight A's, that's a whole other story. We have Neely. How does he meet her? And what happens when he realizes that she may be someone special, and yet he's married and he didn't care?
Right.
And at this point, I give him credit.
He and Nell meet, you know, in a very weird sort of way. He uses the desire card to call her, and Nell's a prostitute. And it happens in a scene where he has a sort of a giant fight with Helene, and it seems almost not that they're getting divorced the next day, but that they've reached sort of a boiling point in their marriage. And for him, and he's a weak person, he's a weak character in terms of the fact that he just goes after his impulses. He doesn't really think for 2 seconds before he does something. So he has a fight with her, and his impulse is basically, I'm going to find somebody who could, you know, show me a little bit of affection when I'm not getting it from my wife, basically. So they meet at a hotel, and it winds up being sort of a great night, and then it turns to a horrific night because his illness really ramps up that night. And Nell is the one who really saves his life. Because if she hadn't been there, he would have completely died had she not called 911. So they meet in a way that it's one of the most intense sort of moments for both of them. for Harrison, obviously, because he almost dies, and for Nael to sort of see that happen to somebody and be the one to really save him, even though they have only known each other for a very short amount of time, their relationship it sort of explodes in terms of that. And Harrison, again, he is a weak person. For him, it sort of almost translates as a type of love. So she becomes like a protector and sort of his like guardian angel a little bit. That had this woman not existed, there wouldn't be a story to tell, basically. So while love may be a strong word, it's definitely like lust almost that he has. And he's not really thinking about Helene when that happens. She sort of becomes the focus. And I mean, I think you could say sometimes that two people, they meet and it can sort of be meant to be. It can be love at first sight, even. Whether, Nael sees that as well, that's sort of left up to the readers. But for Harrison, it's definitely the case.
Well, I think he needed somebody that he felt needed, that wanted him. I
yes,
just think he
yeah.
felt like nobody cared. So his wife
mm-hmm,
was
mm-hmm.
like cold and not what he wanted, and he
mm-hmm.
just felt that he needed
mm-hmm.
somebody in his life. So what happens when he finds out he needs a liver? That's scary.
Super scary. In some ways he's to blame. You learn he hasn't been to a doctor in 5 years. Not smart. You get a yearly checkup no matter what, especially if there are some signs of things going wrong. And he's clearly had some signs over at least the last year that his liver is basically dying. For somebody like Harrison, he's weak in some ways, but he's actually very strong in other ones. So his determination is very strong as a character. So when he hears that he needs a liver transplant, his ultimate goal is, well, I'm going to get one. And even if I'm not, far up on the donor network, I'm going to figure out a way to get one, because for him in his life, he's been able to figure out everything. He came from nothing and he made something out of himself, and he works a very, very stressful, high powered job. There are billions of dollars are transferred back and forth on a daily basis, and he figures it out and he gets it done. So it becomes the same thing with this liver disease. It's just something he's going to tackle, he's going to figure out and ultimately survive from.
Well, he has a friend, or he thought he was, anyway, and he speaks
yes.
to his friend, and he tells him to come to Mumbai, and what happens is really scary, because just when you think you are okay, you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he call this guy, and then what happens is really scary, seriously.
Yes. So his friend Nagesh, he knows him from college, and in college they got into some trouble together, and Nagesh was really the one that took the fall for it. But they've kept in touch over the years, where Nagesh was a medical professional, and he offered Harrison some medical advice sometimes, and Harrison helped him out after 9/11 when Nagesh made some really bad investments. Lost a lot of money, and Harrison sort of steered him in a decent direction. So they've always sort of looked out for each other, even though they weren't close like they were in college. And Nagesh lives in Mumbai, and he has a clinic out there. And on a whim, Harrison decides, I'm going to contact him and see if there's a possibility. He's heard about sort of black market organs coming from India. And again, he's the type of person that lives in impulsivity, and he just contacts him. And sure enough, Nagesh's clinic deals with things like that. So it's almost a too good to be true scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to give away too much of what happens in India.
No, don't.
But
yeah.
Like a lot of things for Harrison, his ideas never wind up turning out the way he plans them to. And it's very, very scary what happens there. But it was also really intense and kind of fun to write as well, because I like characters getting into really difficult situations and having a hard time getting out of them.
He didn't quite look at the situation and the person very clearly. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, he has a way of kind of not seeing the best in somebody, but seeing in
yeah.
somebody what he wants from them rather than what they
yeah.
actually can give to him. I think that's his biggest issue.
He's got to learn not to trust people. Seriously.
I think after this book, he, whether he's got it 100%, it's a little better than when he started, definitely.
Yeah, I think so. So what kind of research did you do into, I know there's a black market for organs. I know that.
Yeah.
I've read enough about it, and I've, learned enough about it in my reading of 10,000 million books. But what research did you do that you decided to choose this particular one? And you must have learned a lot about liver transplant or any kind of organ transplant. And you have to be lucky. I mean, seriously, you have to be lucky to get on the list because it doesn't matter who
Very
you
lucky.
Are.
Very lucky. Yeah. No, it wound up being sort of the perfect organ for the book because, it's true. You could have, millions and millions of dollars. It doesn't help you move up on the list. With the donor list, it's really, a need basis. So somebody who 100% needs it at that moment, it could be a last-minute thing and given to them. And while Harrison is sick and will die, he's almost in a space where he's not dying enough. So it's not imminent. It's soon.
Mm-hmm.
So he falls in sort of that waiting area, and he could get a call tomorrow. He can get a call never, basically. And also the cross match has to fit. So not every liver would work for everybody. And it's actually quite rare. Everything sort of has to match up. And even if everything matches up, it's not 100%. I was really lucky that I spoke to a lot of medical professionals. I never even knew that a liver can regenerate. That was something that I learned from it. And the liver regenerates in basically under a month. So if half of a liver is cut out and everything works out okay, within a month that liver can grow back to normal size. So when I first learned that, I was like, okay, that's perfect for what this book was. And then one of my very close friends is a nurse. And has been in procedures with liver transplants and everything. So she was really my go-to for every question. And I made sure after I finished that she was a reader in those sections and that she okayed everything. So I wasn't, writing anything that would be suspect or not true. So that was sort of that research. And then for the research about the black market, I'm definitely probably flagged in Google at some point because there was a lot of Google searches about black market organ transplants. And I remember watching, I don't remember off the top of my name, but I remember watching some documentaries about it. And then also just books about Mumbai in general. I really immersed myself when I was writing. And the book was written a few years ago. It sort of took a while to A, finish, and then B, find the right publisher for it. But at the time, I really had read a lot of books about India, and I actually didn't go. I had planned on it, and then I kind of just wrote it, and I gave it to people who had spent a considerable amount of time. And then my editor wound up living in Mumbai for 7 years, and they all okayed it and believed it, and I just went with it. Which is rare because usually when I research a place or a country, I've gone and I've done the firsthand research. But this one was all remote.
Well, that is good because I have to tell you, when I read books like this, I do the research too. into Mumbai.
That's good. That's very good.
And heart transplant and liver transplants. And I read a book called The Organ Donor, and I read a whole bunch of books about this and different drug companies and a whole bunch of stuff. So I said, I knew you were credible because
thank you.
That would kill it because, people read my reviews. Your reviews on Amazon, by the way, they just put it on this morning with 17 stars. It's there. Amazon takes... Yeah, they just put it on. I put it on days ago, and it's like, okay, it's about time.
I saw it. I saw it days ago. I definitely saw it.
The email, and I didn't get the email. I put Harlan Coben's one for Runway, and I had a running commentary with somebody on Facebook asking me why I liked the book, and I said, because I did it. You decide for yourself. I don't care. So... Losing so much and returning home, what happens when Helene finds out the truth? And who are these people that find him, the one with the stars and the end result of not – you see, when I do something, I research it. And even if you need a doctor for surgery, I'll research 75 of them and ask a million questions and go to 20 of them before I make my decision.
Mm-hmm. That's
just my craziness. So he comes to some harsh realities. What were you trying to convey? He was really desperate. So why does he decide to go through with this? Seriously, that's scary.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of the book is really about sort of what someone would do when, you know, desperation sort of takes over and almost becomes an obsession in a lot of ways. When, you know, he comes back from India and it doesn't quite turn out the way he planned, he really has no other option. He doesn't want to wait on the donor network. He doesn't feel like he's going to be the next one to be given the liver. So he uses the desire card, and the desire card really is any wish fulfilled. You know, people think that if you get them, you know, a Jackson Pollock painting if they wanted it, or any sort of, you know, monetary desire. But what the company really is for immoral desires. You know, anybody, if they wanted, could get that Jackson Pollock painting. It might not be easy, but if they have the money, they could find sort of an avenue to get it. And while they provide things like that, their main goal is really to provide the unsavory things that people would never be able to get, or even maybe even think that they would be able to get. Getting a liver off the black market becomes that very unsavory thing. And the flip side to the company is, you know, they obviously want their employees to remain incognito. So the company, everybody who works for them, wears masks of old-time movie stars, movie idols. Why I chose that was, there was going to be a lot of characters that worked for this organization, mostly because it's going to be a multiple-book series. And at first, I thought it would be very hard for a reader to connect with all of these different people and descriptions of them. So to have an actual description that people would know, if somebody's wearing a Humphrey Bogart mask, you know what Humphrey Bogart looks like, you could identify with that. So that was sort of my first reason for doing it. And then there's also an element of, you know, we were talking about scary things before. There's something scary when you have the face of somebody you've known for a long time that you trust, you know, somebody like Humphrey Bogart. And then they turn out to be kind of the opposite of how they're portrayed. They're menacing. They're evil. You know, there's a James Dean character. He's evil. Rita Hayworth is evil. So all these people, it sort of flips the notion of how you knew of them. And I feel like also if ever this is adapted into film or TV series, it would really look great on the screen to have sort of these people dressed in that way. And the masks are 100% believable, so it doesn't really look like a mask. It looks like their actual face.
Well, if you want to know more about Hollywood and the author, on June 17th, five big authors have asked me to moderate a show called Hollywood and the Author, and the book was written and edited by Stephen J. Schwartz, and the authors that are going to tell about their experiences, good and bad, are Tess Gerrinson, Lee Goldberg, Lawrence Block, Stephen J. Schwartz, and there's one more somewhere.
That sounds amazing.
Alan Jacobson, who got me to do that. Yeah, it's going to be amazing. And I actually read the five essays and sent the questions to somebody just so that he could check to see my fact checked to make sure I was right. He said the questions were perfect. So for those of you and my somebody that is very close to me, one of my students told me yesterday that Bad Education was written by one of his friends, and he sold it to Netflix. He said it's much easier to sell it to them than it is to sell it to anybody else. But you do lose the rights and the copyrights and the you have to read the book. It's a process. So what happens when these people threaten his family and demand a suitcase? That's scary too.
So, the suitcase is filled with the money that he owes them. And like everything in Harrison, Harrison doesn't turn out the way he planned. So he doesn't want to pay them what he really has owed them. which is not a smart thing, because these people, you know, they don't have to be mercenaries, but as they say often, they will become mercenaries if they need to be. So if you wrong them, they will come after you. And whether it's, you know, women, children, it doesn't matter to them. They are solely after the pursuit of not only money, but the power to manipulate people and to have people under their thumb. And as you learn a little bit more in later books, that's really their driving force. Their force is to have all these very rich people at their whim, basically, either for blackmail or just to be able to do their bidding. So it's an extremely scary organization that Harrison gets himself involved with. And, you know, when his family is threatened, it almost flips the switch for Harrison. It's like you don't know what you got until it might be gone. And the thought that, you know, he would be responsible for something happening to his wife, his kids, really makes him reflect as to, you know, how he brought them all to this place that they're at now, and his responsibility for his, you know, really kind of crappy actions, basically.
Well, I knew when I read the last part of it that there's going to be a sequel. See, I could figure that one out.
Oh, good.
I'm
glad.
I knew that. I said, oh, my God, I got to find out. Especially that last scene that was so sad.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, my God, this poor guy, it's just not right. And I said, I'm sure that Lee Matthew Goldberg is going to come up with more horror for this man to wake up and smell the coffee or something.
There is a sequel. The sequel is called Pray No More, and it will be out. I don't have the
exact date,
but it will be out later this year, definitely, from my publisher, Fahrenheit Press. And the thing about this series of books is it actually won't follow Harrison. The constant in all of these books is the desire card, and it's all about different people who get kind of sucked into the organization. So the main character actually is the character James Dean, who has a very small role in the desire card, and he becomes the main character in the second one. He decides that the organization is sort of too evil for him, and he wants to leave, and you do not leave the organization once you're in. It's kind of like the mob, in a sense. So it's a very sort of white-knuckle, kind of Elmore Leonard meets Tarantino, hunted versus hunter book. And Harrison isn't in it at all, actually. He has no part in it. But in the third book, he pops in again. So in a lot of the books, the characters kind of come in and out, and different people become the main character and the supporting characters.
Yeah, Mike, I just wrote a note to myself. So I'm wondering in the last book if you're going to bring them all together and find out what happens to every one of them at the end.
I've written the third book, and I just finished the fourth book. The third book kind of brings all the characters from the first two together. And the fourth book goes back in time and is about when the card started in the 1970s, and one of their new hires. So it's sort of the inception of the card through Errol Flynn's eyes, basically. And then the fifth card, the fifth book, which I'm thinking probably would be the final one. Really would wrap everything up, and likely will take place in Mexico.
I can't wait to read the second one. I hope I get it before you send it out.
I will make sure you get a copy even before.
You should just add it to the pile on my chair. I scared everybody today. My nephew said he had some stuff to do for school. I said, let me take a picture of my chair and see if you still want me to help.
Yeah.
That my chair has 20 books on it. I love doing that.
It's
so much fun. Yeah, I do. And that's just my chair, except for the two bags behind me that are staring at me for a while. What can I say? I just got a whole bunch of brand new ones that are some good and some, oh, my God.
Hopefully more good than
that. Tell us about this young child. This was sad. I got tears in my eyes. Who was dying in TB, and he wanted to help him. How come he couldn't help him? And what happens when he tries to do something about it? I mean, he's got a heart.
Yeah.
He's not a heartless man. And
he's
a poor child. I cried. Oh, my God.
Oh, well, I mean, That's a huge compliment. I always like to hear, you know, when a reader gets emotional from a book. Yeah, that's really, I think, a turning point, A, for him, and a big turning point in the book and how I think readers look at him. So it takes place that scene takes place when he's in India, and they go to the in the slums to the house of who will be donating the liver to Harrison and that man's family. And there's a little girl who's dying of tuberculosis. And it's heartbreaking. She is at such an end stage that there's really nothing any doctors could do. But the saddest thing is, it's a disease that really is curable in 2019, although the book takes place a few years ago, so 2015. But not for somebody who is born and lives in one of the sort of most deplorable slums in India, where there's really no money for that. There's no medical assistance. And a girl that catches that disease really just dies. Harrison wants his friend Nagesh, because he has a clinic, to help her out, to, you know, save her. But she's really at a point where there's nothing more that he could do. And for somebody like Nagesh, he's seen it. He's dealt with the slums in India before, and he's seen this level of, unfairness. For Harrison, he's never seen it before. And the girl is the same age as his daughter, and I think he 100% pictures his daughter in that situation, pictures how he would handle it, and is really just devastated. And it shows that he really does have a heart. I mean, he's somebody, he's a misguided person, and he's a selfish person. I think he would even admit that.
Mm-hmm.
But
there's
a genuine good in him. And I think as the book progresses, even though if you don't like him 100%, you start to root for him, and you want him to become a better person ultimately at the end. And he really does. I mean, I think that he goes through this horrific sort of crazy twist in his life, and he comes out better than when he started, definitely. Almost that he needed it to happen to kind of put him on that trajectory.
Well, let me not forget, Tuesday at 12 o'clock, Lee Goldberg, Killer Thriller. What would happen if your characters, literally whatever they wrote, came alive and their plots became real? On the 28th, Mark Greene, who's number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list, Mission Critical. On April 3rd, we've got Jerry Farrell, Charles Salzberg, Bruce Coffin, and David Burns, and Larry Thompson. We're going to talk about setting and how it drives the plot forward. On the 4th, this is really scary. Alice and Gerald is a true life story about a real murder. And the author actually interviewed Gerald, who's crazy. He's in jail, and he never told what happened to the bodies of his ex-wife and 2 stepchildren. They're still out there somewhere, and he won't divulge where the bodies are. That's a scary story. On the 8th, I am honored at 12 o'clock again, New York Times author Robert Dagoni, the 8th sister. On the 15th, Red Fish Oak with Jewel Gratman and George Putnam. On the 17th, I'm going to talk to Dylan Volk, who has Asperger's Autism Spectrum. On the 23rd, John Land. On the 25th, David Burnsworth. And to end the month, Michael and Rachel from Trinity House Entertainment Doc Inc. I love their music. They're so beautiful, and it's inspirational. So that's a very great way to end April. And that's just April. Wait till you hear about May. Oh, my God. So when he realizes he's out of options, who is Jay, and why are there strings attached? I mean, with something like this, there's always strings attached.
Sure. I think Jay really becomes sort of the last hope. You know, Jay has a lot of money. He's the CEO of a major corporation, and he's actually donated money to hospitals in New York City. So when Harrison really becomes out of options, even though he hates his father-in-law and his father-in-law hates him,
mm-hmm.
He really becomes the last person that he could ask for help with the liver. And Jay's the type of person that he might actually have the connections to make it happen. If he really, you know, maybe donates another wing to a hospital. So it's really a last effort for somebody like, you know, Jay, even though he hates Harrison, he doesn't want his grandkids to grow up without a father. Mm-hmm. So if he can, he's worth saving to him. Also somebody like Jay is, I think he's somebody who likes a rivalry, and I think he enjoys, hating Harrison and having sort of the power over him. So I think in a weird way, he would miss that if Harrison wasn't around, but he likes his punching bag, basically.
So why did Helene allow him to stay there after the operation? And does he ever realize his priorities? Seriously.
I would think twice, because
I'm surprised she let him stay there.
To stay where?
And that she took care of him after the surgery. I was surprised.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Helene is a very good person. You know, she could raise her kids to be a little less sort of greedy and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We could fault her for that. You know, she works for UNESCO. She works for a very good organization. She raises a lot of money for charity. She's, you know, in a book with a lot of bad people. She's one of the really good ones. And she loves Harrison. You know, she hates him, but she loves him. They've been married for 25 years. They met when she was 19. She's really all he knows. So even if their relationship won't work, she wants the best for him. And she really wants to, you know, save him and keep him around. She wants a father for her kids. So she'll really do anything, even if it means ultimately that a divorce is imminent. She will nurse him back to health because it's just the type of personality that she has.
Well, that's nice, because you don't hate her then, seriously.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, you know, like I said, she has some faults, but she's a good person.
Well, she got so wrapped up in her job, I guess, because he wasn't really there.
Mm-hmm.
So at least she has something.
Yeah.
And she got wrapped up in her kids. I guess she feels guilty because he wasn't there. So she wanted her kids to feel that somebody was there, including the grandfather for them. Yeah, well.
Yeah. And even spoil them, you know.
I didn't have grandparents that spoiled me. They just let me know, get those straight A's and you'll be a very happy person. And yeah.
That's good advice. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I live with my grandparents when I grew up, and that was the best thing that could have happened to me.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
We all lived in the same apartment, in the same building, a whole bunch of us, and it was the best thing that ever happened. And we lived in my room was as big as my thumb that I shared with my sister, and you know what? It was fine. Nobody ever realized that. Not only would it work, I wasn't one of those kids that had our own telephone or TV. My grandmother owned the television, and you weren't going to watch it until her stories were over. That's why books. So sometimes you want things so badly, we don't see the dark shadow that will hide your happiness and mask that will cover your face. When he thinks he might find some solace, Harrison tries to rekindle his hope. So he gets a new job. What does he get? And what about this girl that he met? Is he still...
Harrison worked in mergers and acquisitions on Wall Street, but he realizes he doesn't basically want to make, you know, billionaires more money, which is what he was doing.
Yeah.
You know, I think he sees what Helene did for her job, and he wants to do something like that. So I had actually had a friend who worked in mergers and acquisitions who I was talking to when I was writing the book, and I asked, I was like, is there any way that charities could use mergers and acquisitions, that somebody who possibly was working for a company like that could do it in the nonprofit spec? And she was like, yeah, absolutely. And I found very little about it, but a little bit about companies that really use that knowledge that somebody would have to either merge charities together to make them stronger. So what Harrison does is he finds a company like that really is only about good, which is the opposite of Sanford and Company. And he gets to work on a project where it's really bringing books to an underprivileged school in Haiti. And it becomes for him, I think, way more, you know, powerful and rewarding than anything he did for 25 years when he was in Wall Street, where he actually sees kids who need books and that he's able to have that happen for them. And I think his heart just swells because of that.
That's so scary. I know. So he's living at home. And what about his children? I mean, Helene is helping him. What about his two kids? Do they do anything to show any kind of loyalty after the surgery, or are they just the same, just sort of ignore him?
I mean, I think it wouldn't be 100% believable if all of a sudden, you know, a switch was flipped and they're like, we love you, Daddy, you're amazing. But I think, when anybody also, especially a small child, and they realize that they might have almost lost their dad, I think it does bring them closer together, and that he's spending more time with them. So he has a job that's not, you know, working till midnight every night, that he's able to have them a few times a week. I think twice a week he has them, and he could take them to the zoo and do all the things that he really was never able to do with them. So they start a new relationship almost. Whether it's, you know, absolute love at the start, you know, probably not, but it could get there. You know, his kids are young enough where there's still an ability to build a new and foster a new relationship. And for him, every day is, a blessing, because it was something that could have been taken away from him very, very easily. So I think he'll pour everything into his new job and also into the relationship with his kids as well.
Well, doesn't she meet somebody else too, Helene?
So Helene meets this guy, Peter, who works in the same sort of field as UNESCO that she does, and is really somebody just better suited for her. Is somebody who isn't about, you know, the just getting money like Harrison was, and really wants to make the world and the environment a better place. So they meet, and it's very early on in their relationship when the book ends. You know, it's they're only about a month into it, but Harrison, I think, could already see that they're more made for each other than he ever was with his wife.
And how do the kids feel about him?
I mean, I think the kids are dealing with a lot. It's, you know, it's a lot thrown at them at once. And I think that there's a line where the little girl is like, I like him, he has nice teeth. So they figure out their own way to like him. And again, they haven't had a father figure for a long time. Mm-hmm. So somebody that's, you know, nice to them, that's kind to them. I think that they're both smart enough to realize that their parents should not be together, and that it's better off if they both find new people. So I think they'll embrace him as long as he embraces them.
Well, as long as he doesn't try to tell them what to do as an experienced person.
Yeah, and knows his place in the relationship.
Yeah, it becomes hard when you're a step-parent. I know. I know. So I'm going to read this quote. This is really good. It is hard to contend against one's heart desire if whatever it wishes to have, it buys at the cost of soul. How come you added that at the beginning of the book? I thought that was really, that sort of sets the tone for the whole thing.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I really wanted to, with all my books, with sort of the quote that begins, I really want that to be the theme of the book. That's really what the book is about. It's about, you know, we all have desires. And all the things that we want in life. And it's good to have sort of a goal and a pursuit, but to have that be an obsession where it takes over and it sort of kills your soul as well is never a good thing. And each character in the book, the main characters, they all have their desires that become their pursuits. And, you know, for each one of them, they're not really seeing the forest for the trees. They're not seeing what's really important. They're solely focused on personal acceleration and getting ahead, that it becomes a detriment to actually living and being good people.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm on my Facebook wall, and there are people that are listening. I have to tell you that. And mm-hmm. there are people that are saying, can I have the book next? And I'm telling
them,
go
wow.
buy it yourself. Yeah. I, you know what I had to do, to be very honest? I printed out the book, had to print it out.
Mm-hmm.
And because I
mm-hmm.
printed it out, it's in large print. Yay.
Oh.
the book weighs more than my 107 pounds, but it makes it so much easier when a book is in large print. And what's been happening
yeah.
is that a lot of publishers are publishing books in print that's so small that I can't read them.
It's true.
That if
yeah,
I don't get
yeah.
permission from the author to take it to FedEx and have it redone,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I can't
mm-hmm.
review it. And sometimes the font is less than one. It's so small that
really?
I really can't. No one could. Yeah, it's too small.
Yeah.
So I said, yeah,
I find with trade paper,
is,
with like mass market, sometimes it's very hard for me. And I have perfect vision, and it's hard for me to read it even.
No, this last one that I had, I said, my God, the font wasn't even there. And then if you don't put
mm-hmm.
like a space between it, I go like, how am I going to write it right? How am I going to
underline?
How am I going to mark it up? I mean, forget
right,
it.
Right.
So the ending lets readers know that the simple card can be your savior. In this case, I think it's a permanent noose around your neck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What would Harrison say if he had to do it all over again?
That's a great question. I love it described as a permanent noose. I might actually use that in a future book. You know,
be my
I like
guest.
That a lot.
Be my guest.
Yeah, that's a very good way to describe it. Yeah, no, it's awesome. I think 100% he wouldn't do things the way that he did them in the book. But like I said, at the same time, he changes a person. He learns from it. So in a lot of ways, had he not done all these things, he might have been even in a worse situation. So there's an element, I think, of yeah, this was terrible, but I needed to hit rock bottom so I could finally mm-hmm. kind of raise up from it. But yeah, I mean, for anybody who is thinking about using the desire card, it's not going to turn out well. So I highly, if it did exist, I don't recommend it. But it makes me think that are there things out there like that for the uber rich? You know, we live in a world where there's such a discrepancy between rich poor. And the book, when I started it, really came out during the Occupy Wall Street era, where it was all about sort of, you know, the one percenters versus the 99%. And it really got me thinking mm-hmm. about that and how, you know, I mean, we even see it, you know, today in politics and things like that. it seems like, you know, the rich can get away with whatever it is they want. And I wanted to write a book and a series really about that they can, that they think they can, but they ultimately, you know, we just in the news, there was about the college scandals. People are paying $500,000 to get their kid in. It's a thing that keeps happening and happening and happening. And as we learn from that, you know, they got busted. It's not going to turn out well for them. And was it really worth it? You know, is it really worth it to buy your way through life or to get things, you know, where you're really working hard to get them? And I want sort of all my characters to if they haven't realized it by the end of each book to have realized it. And that ultimately, you know, for somebody like the owner of the desire card, who is a constant in the books, that mm-hmm. they will get their just ultimately in the end.
I don't know. I paid my own way through school. Nobody paid my way
yeah.
to get in. And I had to have
yeah,
the grades,
and,
otherwise it wasn't good. Yet
mm-hmm.
I have like four masters and a PhD and all the rest of it, and it cost me a fortune. But I don't think I would want the easy way out. I don't want the easy way out. I never did. And I said, if I don't earn it, I don't want it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
seriously. And
mm-hmm.
for 36 years, I was teaching and I earned it. And I worked
mm-hmm.
four
mm-hmm.
jobs. And, I, you know, you pay your own way. I don't think I would want to get into college knowing that somebody paid $500,000 just for me to sit
oh,
there
yeah.
and vegetate. And,
yeah.
and half the time, these people don't even go to class from what I understand. They're not even there.
Well,
and
I also,
that,
I mean, if
me.
That was, if it was my parents, I would be like, do you really think I'm that dumb that I couldn't get into a college that you had to
yeah,
pay $500,000?
Exactly.
Like, it's
exactly.
really, it's
exactly.
demeaning almost. I mean, there's a million colleges out
yeah.
there. Not everybody has to go to like an Ivy League or anything. You can go to any college and make something of yourself from that. I mean, I think the desire card really is the easy way out. You know, it's any
yeah.
desire you want for the right price. and the price is always more than anybody intends to pay, and it often money is not the end game of that price. That
I agree with you, but I beg a bet that if somebody got offered it today, they probably would take it without even thinking.
Sure.
Because there are a lot of young people out there that think that they could just have whatever they want, and they don't realize that, you know, working for it and earning it, I don't know, maybe I was brought up in a crazy, my family, my nephew's the same way. Everybody has to earn it themselves. And there's no such thing as graduating college and not working. So where can everybody learn more about you and your work? Because we have about 3 minutes left on my timer over here.
My name is Lee Matthew Goldberg. You can go to leematthewgoldberg.com. I have two other novels out there. My last was called The Mentor, which is published by St. Martin's Press and is about an editor in a publishing house who's contacted by his favorite professor in the world, who's been writing this book for 10 years. That is his, you know, magnum opus. And the editor reads it, and it's the worst thing ever written and really, really, really disturbing. And it starts to remind him of a cold case from when they were in school together and a girl he briefly dated went missing. And so he starts to wonder if the professor had something to do with it. And things don't turn out well. And then my first novel is called Slow Down, and it's about somebody who wants to become a movie director so bad that he might even kill for it. And so all three of the books all have a noir suspense thriller kind of genre to them. So you can find me on leematthewgoldberg.com. The books are on Amazon, and this latest book is published by Fahrenheit Press. So you could find the book either through their website, or through Amazon, and then also look for the next book, Pray No More, which should be out later this year. And I hope you enjoy all of them. And thank you so much for having me. This was
such an awesome
interview.
You're going to use the same publisher, Fahrenheit Press, for the next one. I love St. Martin's Press. They love me too.
St. Martin's Press
book. I love them.
St. Martin's Press is great. Fahrenheit Press is amazing, and it was the only publisher that really wanted the series. So that was one of the reasons why I chose them. That other people were reticent to buy multiple books. And Fahrenheit Press was like, it's awesome. We love it. We want the first two books. They've been really, really cool. And they're a very punk rock publisher. And they have all these kind of new ideas and things that they're doing. So, yeah, and if you're in England, the books are also out there in the UK.
I just sent my new book. I don't know if I did the right thing. A regular, a St. Martin's Press kind of publisher took it.
Mm-hmm,
and
they've
been reading it since January.
Congratulations.
And I have no idea if they're taking it. They didn't tell me. I emailed the guy 2 weeks ago. And I said, if you're not going to take it, there were three other publishers that said they would. And it's called Silent Voices, and it's told from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone. I'm serious. The person got there because they did something wrong and they deserved to be dead, and I killed them off my way. Or somebody did something to them, and they wind up behind the gravestone. And in this particular one, the first two are based on real-life incidents. My grandmother was in a Polish sterilization camp. It's her story. And the second one is my other grandmother that was sold into slavery to her aunt and uncle when she came here.
Oh,
the other
God.
One's purely my brilliant imagination of whatever. So I'm hoping that they take it. And if they don't, there are three other publishers that said that it's crazy. And they would. It's the fifth one in my Faces Behind the Stone series. And... The reason why I wrote that is because when my sister died, I went to the cemetery and said, if you could tell me what really happened to you, maybe I could write it. And then I walked around the cemetery and said to each stone, did you do something right or wrong to get here? I don't know. What can I say?
That's interesting. And, everybody deals with death and has lost somebody. And I think everybody has those questions, basically. So it's very relatable, I think.
I hope so. So I'm going to ask, before it even comes out, I'm going to ask a whole bunch of people to give me blurbs because I'm definitely bothering everybody. I will definitely ask you, without a doubt.
So 100%.
It's raining outside, but this was a great interview, and I hope I get more of your books because this is really great. For those of you that think everything is worth it and you want a desire card, Read this book and you'll decide whether you really think that's what you want. Thank you so much, Lee Matthew Goldberg.
Thank
Everybody
you so
have
much,
a nice
friend.
Day. You're welcome, and bye.
Take care.